WRCT,
Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines.
I'm Janine Jackson.
This week on Counterspin,
news media coverage of taxes
falls broadly into two camps.
There are, especially in April,
lots of news you can use type stories.
Like NBC Today Show, warning viewers to be mindful of typos
and not to be lazy about filing for extensions.
Or NBC Nightly News noting that if you file by mail, you might wait five to eight months for your return
due to backlogs at the IRS.
Taxes, in other words, as in, well, what are you going to do, sort of thing that all of us have to deal with.
Then there are other disconnected stories about tax policy.
Who pays, how much, and why?
We've talked about that a fair amount on this show,
and we're going to revisit two of those conversations today.
Last April, we spoke with Emily College law professor and author Dorothy A. Brown about how, though you can scour tax policy and find no mention of race,
our tax system still affects black people very differently in ways most conversation obscures.
And in February of 2019, we spoke with economist Dean Baker about why the idea of raising taxes on the super wealthy makes sense to many mainstream economists and to the general public,
but still faces a perennial headwind in corporate media.
Two revelatory conversations about tax policy this week on Counterspin.
Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Fair.
In the United States today, the median white family, not average but median, above half below, has a net worth, that means wealth or assets minus debts or liabilities,
eight times that of the median black family.
That's the same gap as 40 years ago.
Despite gains that black people have made in income and education and all of the things that you do to accrue wealth.
So what's going on and what does it have to do with our system of taxation?
In April of 2021, we spoke with Dorothy Brown. She's a Grant Chandler professor of law at Emory University School of Law and author of the book The Whiteness of Wealth,
how the tax system impoverishes black Americans and how we can fix it.
I asked her first of all to address the fact that although black people are underpaid generally and shuttled into work sectors that are underpaid, employment income, how much money comes in, is different from tax policy,
though they are related.
That's right. So how much income you have helps in what black American engagement in the same activity, whether it's whether owning a home, whether married, paying for college, how policy subsidizes the way white American engagement in the activity, while the disability agency, the way black American engagement in the activity.
So let's just get into that a little more. What are some of the ways that happens?
Well, we can start with jobs. So we know that occupational segregation, right, jobs are disproportionately filled by white Americans, and other jobs are disproportionately filled by black Americans. But there are tax subsidies associated with jobs. Employer provided retirement accounts. Any money that we're putting in a retirement account, it's not taxed today, even though it's wage income. It will be taxed later when you retire and withdraw the amount. And presumably, in 20, 30, 40 years, when you retire, you won't be working. And the amount of income tax paid on that retirement amount will be less.
Right?
If you were to pay the money today, and your other income, you're paying higher taxes. So it's a big tax rate. Well, what we know are jobs that are proportionally held by white Americans are more likely to come with retirement benefits. But when a black American is fortunate enough to get such a job, we are likely to participate and contribute to that benefit. And if we aren't able to participate in the retirement account, we're more likely to draw an amount early that's subject to a tax penalty. Don't have to have college graduates, or more likely to receive money from their parents, to help them pay for the necessities, or in college graduates, or more likely to receive money from their parents, to help them out with the down payment for a home, to take the $12,000 to $5,000 school, children, so they've been even if the black American and the black American making the amount, we know that doesn't happen, right? Because the free Mr. Grant, in the labor market, but even if I'm buying that, the black girl, because their parents and grandparents and grandchildren grow, is going to be more likely to have less after-tax dollars because they're going to send money home.
Right, you know, Jeremy from Enterprise Development told me income helps you get by, but wealth helps you get ahead and allows you to think about the future. And it's so critical. And if you don't have to think of it that way, well, then you don't think of it that way.
Yeah, and that's just the law, is what we're hearing, you know.
And yet, we see corporations write tax law favorably to themselves. We see Congress carve out exceptions or offer rebates for specific individual companies, like it looks like sausage is being made. And yet we're somehow disinclined to think that corruption and cronyism might include systemic racism.
Everyone, and I have to use those terms loosely, but people agree that black people are behind, are disadvantaged, whatever their explanation for that is.
But then when it's time to intervene, to allow, not help, but allow, to stop preventing black people getting ahead,
it becomes a whole different conversation about the intervention and its unfairness.
And I just wanted to ask you, why have previous policy responses failed to adequately address the wealth gap, and then what sort of responses could?
So, also, you know, we have a lot of research on the wealth gap, and we have proposals for how to address this. But one of the problems is you have the left and the right seeing different causes of it. And I have quote with the left.
Suddenly people wanted to talk about race and tax. I don't want you to burn any bridges with borders, but I am curious, when you talk to media, where do you have to start? Do you find people disbelieving? Are they ready to see that this is real? And it doesn't have to be a media, but just the general public. Do you feel like the moment's right to push this forward?
I will say George Floyd, 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 George Floy reporters that I've talked to and that I've tried to talk about race, very dismissive. And there are different people who have not come back to me, George Floyd, right? So people who came to me were all new white reporters who I hadn't talked to before, who actually saw the moment and wanted to get better and so that kind of partnering, to be honest with you, I haven't had pushback, and I will say over years, the audience that gave me the most comfort was the general public audiences. They were curious and listening and attentive. It would be white academics who didn't want to hear anything I had to say. So general public has always been an encouragement for me to endure this work.
We've been speaking with Dorothy Brown, Asa Griggs Campbell, professor of law at Emory University School of Law. The book is The White Wealth of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. It's out now from Crown. Thank you so much, Dorothy Brown, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dorothy A. Brown speaking Counterspin in April of 2021. One in three GoFundMe campaigns in this country are for medical expenses, and one in five households have zero or negative wealth. And this is the same society in which there are also some people who can't remember how many houses they own. Inequality is a life or death issue, which makes it especially worrying that some people with media megaphones seem proudly ignorant of the basic mechanisms by which resources are distributed. And some of those myths and misunderstandings were thrown into relief in early 2019 when we saw a rather lowered conversation about progressive taxation. Occasioned by proposed from New York Senate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others. We spoke with Dean Baker, founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. I asked him first of all to talk about top marginal tax rates and increased taxes on extreme wealth in the wake of a proposal from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez suggesting the idea of a top marginal tax rate of 70%, as well as wealth tax proposals from Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, which had been received by the media as though they were ideas from Mars.
The reaction to both proposals has been fascinating, both the public reaction, there's been a lot of support, a lot of people watching the taxes, but more so from the media and some established politicians. So the reaction is, here's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where she did off 70%. And in fact, that's the number that many of the world's most prominent economists have said, this is the maximum tax rate, maximum amount of revenue. And there was an article by Professor Berkeley Goldberg, Diamond Nobel Prize, John Bates Clark Award, two of the most prestigious awards you can get as professionals. These are people who are very understanding, and they came up with their own qualifications and reservations. But in any case, they just think it's ridiculous. So when you have a fresh new member of Congress propose that, the media jumped on that like something's changed, and in fact, it's a very reasonable thing to put on the table. Whether it's the right rate, of course they could debate that. But it certainly was not a ridiculous proposal, and again, Paul Krugman has a very nice piece where he's contrasting that with the Republican proposals to cut taxes on the rich, where they were saying that they would pay for themselves, which weren't ridiculous. But that was treated like these are serious people. So it's been fascinating that there's been such a rush to dismiss these far-out proposals by radical leftists when they're reasonable proposals, which again is not to say that they're necessarily bad policy, but there's reasonable proposals to put on the table and to be debated.
We read that Michael Dell, who has $30 billion at the World Economic Forum, apparently said, Name a country where that's worked ever. The 70% top marginal rate, missing something, I could say.
Yeah, of course, it was one analyst in the United States that wasn't the rate in the United States until Ronald Reagan lowered it to 1981. And if we go back a little further, it was 90% in the Eisenhower candidate lowered it to 70%. So again, one could argue whether these are the best rates. But treat this as crazy idea out of far left field is just wrong. And some of the back and forth, because I was on Twitter with Dell and there were others involved, obviously. And what I find most striking here, Dell's kind of a poster child here, because what is Dell's expertise in this area? He's very rich, no doubt about that. But he obviously knows nothing about tax rates. I mean, again, we could disagree 70% the right rate, but to act like that's just impossible.
collapse. That's not. He knows nothing about it. $30 billion for their employee qualified to talk about it.
Well, it's good. I think that we're talking about taxing extremely high incomes and wealth for all kinds of reasons. The LA Times, as Michael Hill was saying, it helps move us away from this notion that wealth is self-made. You know, that these folks owe nothing to society and it disrupts the fallacy trickle down. But having said that, it does take the form of a give back. You've got an absurd amount of money, so you should throw some back in the pot because that's the socially decent thing to do. You suggest in this recent piece for Truthout that while that is not wrong, it's not getting to the crux, the bigger source of the rise in inequality.
The point I made in my writing over the last 10 or 15 years is that the distribution of income is not something that just happens, it depends on how we structure the economy. And I would say pretty much, we can structure it all sorts of different ways. And my favorite example here, because it's so blatant, is I like to say, how rich would the Bill Gates be if he didn't have a copyright or monopoly on Windows software? So if anyone in the world could just start producing copy and Windows and all the other Microsoft software, and even send them a thank you note. Well, needless to say, he would not be one of the richest people in the world. He wouldn't have $100 billion. I'm sure he'd do fine, but, you know, someone like Bill Gates could become incredibly wealthy because of how we designed that market. And it's pretty much the same story everywhere you look. Finance, where would all these Goldman Sachs guys be if we didn't have a bailout? No way. Let me just look at market course, and there's many other ways to find wealth as well. Corporate CEOs, they were always well paid. But if you go back to the pay standards of the 60s and 70s, they'd be getting $2 or $3 million a year, not $30 or $40 million. So we structure rules that allow people to get incredibly wealthy. And I really prefer that to be the focus, both because it's a practical matter, it's harder to get the money back. Once they have it, there's all sorts of practical issues that people rightly raise, and one of the ones that wants to tax the wealth. Well, and that's to hand it over to you, it's going to be hard to do. They didn't say it's not something we might want to do. Maybe it's going to be hard. And secondly, the political issue, if we act as though, Bill Gates got that square. We shouldn't take any of it back. You go, well, we could kind of structure it differently, and then Bill Gates won't have it, and then we don't even have to have this discussion.
I wonder, do you think it's a trap to talk about these things in terms of revenue, in terms of how much money it would bring into the economy? I read a piece by Vanessa Williamson from Brookings where she said that taxes on the very wealthy should be judged by their societal impact and not simply by their revenues. And that it has to do with the fact that just having some people be so wildly wealthy is incompatible with democracy. And so we shouldn't get too hung up on how much money it would give to the economy to institute some of these changes. What do you make of that?
I think it's a very important point, and I remember some years ago, there was a piece on the estate tax done by Lisa Minnell, now at Valley College, and she came up with the figure that we get a relatively small amount of revenue from the estate tax. I'm saying relatively small, still substantial, but much less than that. Here's how many rich people died, and what is the 40% rate? We get a very small amount relative to that. But she wasn't writing as a critic of the tax. Which is the point she was making, one is exactly this one. Part of the story is we don't want massive amounts of wealth handed down. So you get Donald Trump's kids walking away with billions, having all this political influence. But the other part of what they do to avoid the tax is things like start foundations, like the Ford Foundation. Those aren't my dreams, there's a lot of things I can say about the way those foundations are run. But the point is that they're all together a lot of society because they do some good things. So they're going to have a tax, they're just going to start a foundation that provides inoculation to children in Africa. Well, that's not a bad thing. So to just look at it and say, okay, how much revenue are we getting from this tax is missing the point.
Well, going back to Michael Dell, he said, my wife and I set up a foundation and we would have contributed quite a bit more than a 7% tax rate on my annual income. And I feel much more comfortable with our ability as a private donation to allocate those funds than I do giving them to the government.
Well, I guess I have my father, Michael Dell, he still could do that.
Exactly. But I think I think what people are saying is the problem isn't whether that's true in real numbers, the problem is running a society on noblesse oblige.
We don't want to depend on their goodwill. I mean, people need health care. They need education. All the other necessities of life. And it should depend on whether Michael Dalzy and his wife are good people and they're going to contribute to that. It's money if they want it, but that won't be what we depend on.
Well, a poll from that Pinko Rag Business Insider that showed that Ocasio-Cortez's proposal, 70% top marginal tax rate, was more popular than the GOP tax cuts, which you alluded to before. People don't even think that socialism is a curse word anymore, which removes a real arrow from some folks' quiver. But I think we want to say that none of these proposals, working on pre-tax income, post-tax income, they're not opponents of one another as proposed, right? And other things like raising the minimum wage could fit in there, too. I guess it just does seem like more ideas are on the table than we've grown accustomed to, and I wonder how we keep that window open and how we keep pushing for more. Center for Economic and Policy Research, online at Seeper.net. And that's where you can also get hold of Dean's free book called Rigged. His piece, Progressive Taxes Only Go So Far, Pre-Tax Income is the Problem, can be found at truthout.org. Dean Baker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for being on again.
That was Dean Baker from February of 2019. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by Fair, the National Media Watch based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, find the show's transcripts at fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. I was like, I'm here to be a big one.
Many things to talk about in this first portion of today's Friday show. First, I want to follow up on a story from earlier this week. We talked about a former Fox News host, Ryle Riley, absolutely losing it at an airport, treating JetBlue employees terribly because their flight to Turks and Caicos was running very, very late. Well, the man who supports the party of personal responsibility and taking responsibility and holding people accountable for their actions.
He says, really, this is Biden's problem.
And it's because of Biden that he flipped out on a worker at the airport. As a reminder, let's start with the original clip. It was Bill O'Reilly at JetBlue in JFK Airport, threatening to get a worker fired and demanding his name and aggressively leaning towards the guy and all of that.
It's not the gate agent's fault.
Like I said, you don't treat people like that. Now he starts threatening losing your job. You're going to find out.
That was the incident.
Now we have an explanation from Bill O'Reilly.
And he's blamed Biden.
I don't know, guys. Maybe there's something to it.
Bill O'Reilly says it's Biden's fault.
He threw a fit.
And the statement is,
on Tuesday O'Reilly tweeted, the character assassins on social media are completely lying about my interaction with the JetBlue guy who misled passengers during a five-hour delay. I expected this.
Speaking to media,
O'Reilly acknowledged that he handled the situation poorly.
And could have used different words, but refused to apologize.
He claimed numerous people recognized him about the whole thing. He almost became like a union rep.
Bill O'Reilly was just speaking for the people.
That's what was going on.
He insisted the heat on him is a distraction from the real story,
which is that JetBlue is subpar.
The story is JetBlue can't get their flight off the ground.
It's crazy in the terminal.
For some reason, the Biden administration is not big on solving problems, and this is a huge problem.
How this has to do with Joe Biden, I truly have no idea.
And the story here, remember, there's two stories here.
One story is they say they're all about personal responsibility.
When they do something, when they choose to behave a certain way,
And it's horrible, and they get called out.
They blame somebody else.
And secondly, they always insist in political discussions.
You must state your principles.
Give me your list of principles here.
One of the principles is personal responsibility.
As soon as the principles are inconvenient,
they ignore the principles.
They abandon the principles.
And that's the way it works.
As I said before, and I'll say it again.
I have been so frustrated.
Some of the most frustrating situations I can remember relate to airlines.
Once my flight was just canceled.
There was no reason.
Wait, but so
is there a technical problem?
No, no.
Is there a weather problem?
No, no.
The flight has been canceled.
Never an explanation.
I lost the day.
We're rebooking you tomorow.
You want to start screaming, but you don't.
You realize it's not this person's fault.
And I guess when O'Reilly says that they were being misled.
I know that feeling.
It's very common when they fly that they say, folks.
We have just a light on that's on the plane, and we want maintenance to look at it.
It's just going to be 10 minutes until they get here.
So we're going to hold off on boarding for now.
Okay. Well, 10 minutes go by, and they say,
we're still waiting for maintenance.
And finally maintenance gets there.
But they said it was 10 minutes for maintenance to get there.
They didn't say anything else.
Maintenance has identified a problem,
and we're going to look for a part here.
And if we get it, it's only about an hour fix.
Once we find the part.
Okay.
45 minutes go by.
We've not been able to find the part.
It is an hour fix once we find the part.
But this actually happened to be in Las Vegas.
They said the closest part right now is in San Diego.
We found the part.
And it's only an hour to install it.
But it's cutting in on a San Diego flight.
That flight leaves San Diego in a half hour.
Very short flight.
Now you're doing math. You're going, okay, wait.
So we're already 75 minutes delayed.
The flight doesn't leave for 45.
And it takes 45 minutes to get the part.
And then it's another hour.
And then you get to,
unfortunately,
this didn't happen to me,
but then the classic is
our crew has timed out.
They now are mandated to rest.
Which I have no problem with.
We want everybody to be rested.
Unrested
crew and pilots flying.
And then you lose a day.
I get it.
These things are frustrating.
You don't start treating people like that.
That's really the principle we should all be sticking to.
Bill O'Reilly blaming everybody but himself.
I have a clip for you today
that is one of the most dangerous clips I can remember ever playing on this program.
And the reason it's dangerous isn't because the person in the video, Candace Owens,
is uniquely dangerous herself.
If you go on the New York subway platform,
right, as I often do,
you see unhinged people saying wacky things.
They're yelling them.
Sometimes they're yelling at no one.
But they're not dangerous
because no one's paying attention to them.
If the crazy subway guy...
I don't mean the Jared guy subway, the New York subway.
If the crazy New York subway guy...
Had a million people following them on social media,
and 150 or 200 or 300 people paying to hear them speak.
Wow, that subway guy is really dangerous.
That's the case with Candace Owens.
Now remember, Candace Owens falsely claimed that the comedian Vegas Sagitt
probably died from the COVID vaccine.
He died from a hit to the head.
Okay.
Here she is saying she believes they
Intentionally kill people in hospitals during COVID.
And people clap and nod and people agree.
Well, I'm a big believer that they intentionally kill people in hospitals during COVID.
Now who is they?
Okay, so let's pretend that these claims are subjected to actual standards.
Versus Candace, who is they?
Is it the nurses?
Is it the doctors?
Is it hospital administrators?
Did some kind of covert government operatives infiltrate the hospital and sneak around and the nurses didn't notice?
And who is they?
Let me personally say, when I went to an asthma clinic, they would not give me life-saving asthma treatment because breathing was not allowed.
Candace, who didn't allow breathing?
And how did you survive
if you weren't allowed to breathe?
And if they had not sent an ambulance, I mean, I have an asthma attack, it was about a very short window of time. I was having an asthma attack. And the doctor had this life-saving medicine and said that the CDC had barred them from giving me the release. So there was no question that they colluded to kill American citizens so that they could fluff numbers and say that people died of COVID.
I still, to this day, question the use of ventilators. It makes entirely no sense when they need oxygen, not compression on their chest when they're dealing with something that's on their chest.
Of course, a ventilator doesn't deprive you of oxygen.
So from top to bottom, yes. Our government wants people to die. There's no question.
Now understand that there's often a conflict with a lot of these conspiracy theories. she says
they were killing people
to fluff up COVID death numbers.
Others say
the numbers are just bogus.
The numbers are invented out of thin air.
And of course there's a conflict, right?
Because if the numbers are just invented out of thin air to make the deaths seem high,
why would you need to go in and kill people?
In order for them to be really dead and reported as COVID,
because they're just making up the numbers.
You don't need both.
It's a conflict.
It doesn't matter.
Because it's a narrative.
And we're talking about crimes against humanity.
People should face long prison sentences. People should face tribunals because of what they did.
Tribunals? What are you talking about? During COVID.
And not even that, the masking of children, the treatment of special needs kids that were being forced to be masked on planes that were having, essentially the trauma that was put to people on a psychological level.
Right.
Now she's speaking of the emotional trauma.
He should bring the tribunals. People like Bill Gates and Fauci in prison.
What crime did Bill Gates commit?
Be among them. This was corruption top to bottom. And it was all done because they had already predestined the vaccine. Right? They denied treatment. They denied the use of hydroxychloroquine.
Now remember.
If this was subjected to actual rigor, we would say, what evidence do you have that hydroxychloroquine works for treating COVID?
And she would either not know or say, I don't know. There's 35-person study in France or whatever.
Well, we have randomized controlled trials.
Really good, we have proper science shows that it works.
Now she says ivermectin.
Same thing with ivermectin.
What evidence do you have that ivermectin works for COVID?
There is none.
That is randomized controlled trials.
They say it doesn't work.
But it's diarrhea of dishonesty.
The media was complicit in it, and it infuriates me. Infuriates me that were allowed to die and to suffer when there were medicines that were new that they could not get emergency use authorization if there was.
All right.
So you hear stuff like this.
And remember, people who believe this stuff sit on juries.
I've told my story when I had jury duty on my 21st birthday.
And it was appalling.
It was appalling that it was a simple self-defense assault case.
And a third of the jury did not even understand the law.
It wasn't about we disagree about the facts.
It wasn't about we have different opinions about who's credible.
A third of the jury didn't understand the law that was supposed to be adjudicated.
Used to adjudicate the facts of the case.
So the people who believe the ventilator deprived you of oxygen.
Or they killed people.
These people are on juries.
They teach school.
They might be your dentist. They might be your accountant.
I don't know.
But more critically, they're your dentist.
You don't like to be a different dentist.
You can't choose your jury.
You only to some degree can choose your teacher, whatever the case may be.
These people are extraordinarily dangerous.
And they have followers.
And it's absolutely horrifying.
I told you recently that it was a really bad launch for CNN Plus.
Streaming wing of CNN.
Under 10,000 viewers a day.
The David Pakman Show is dramatically bigger than CNN Plus.
And they spent...
Is it tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on it?
It's crazy.
And just like that, CNN Plus is shutting down.
Not even a month in.
Warner Brothers Discovery is shutting down CNN Plus as of April 30.
Marking one of the company's first significant maneuvers to complete the merger of Warner Media and Discovery less than two weeks ago.
This puts an end to CNN Plus.
This decision is in line with WBD's broader direct-to-consumer strategy,
said Chris Licht, the incoming CEO of CNN.
In a complex streaming market, consumers want simplicity and all-in-service, which provides a better experience and more value than the standalone offering.
I don't think that's the case.
I talked about this on a stream.
We, little old us and our colleagues in independent progressive media,
We are not part of a network.
We are not part of a marketing strategy.
And yet we have plenty of audience that is larger than CNN and audience crossover.
The fact that people want to watch me and then Sam Cedar and then the Young Turks
and whatever else, right?
We're
You can find us on YouTube. We have YouTube channels, but our podcasts are in different places. We have all different schedules. Lynn is completely different. And people watch all of the shows. They don't need everything to be all in one solution.
I think what the problem is that
CNN Plus tried to capitalize generally on the growth in streaming, which may no longer be growing. Considering that Netflix saw a loss of subscribers for the first time in history.
We may be reaching saturation at this point in time.
But CNN Plus wanted to jump in generally on the popularity of streaming.
But they weren't bringing known content into the sense of like Netflix and Amazon Prime, at least go, here's 10 shows I love, I already love, they're all there.
With CNN Plus, it was original content on a platform that nobody had any emotional connection to. Not that everybody's emotional connection to me is so positive. We have a lot of haters. But the idea here is, people are in the audience, they want to hear from me, our team, us, our guests,
the callers, the community.
There was absolutely no community aspect to CNN Plus.
The technology wasn't innovative or notable.
It's just a dud, there's no other way to say, and you'll see some of these other services end up going the same way.
It doesn't bring me pleasure, but it makes me reassured that it is not a clear, everybody likes to have a hot take about what the future is.
Early on, the legacy TV people were saying streaming is not going to take over.
Oh, they were wrong.
Then the streaming people said,
we're going to have indefinite growth, and first mover advantage will prevent Netflix and Amazon Prime from ever having any issues.
And growth started slowing down, and competitors entered the market,
and you've got Apple TV with Ben Stiller's great show,
all these different things.
And so actually, they were wrong too.
There's no one path forward.
And I think the takeaways are flexibility.
Genuine content and putting the connection to the audience ideally first, rather than saying we're CNN.
We'll just put a plus sign after it, and people want random shows.
Our friend Rex Chapman, former NBA player.
I hope I'm right.
He had, or might continue to have, I don't know.
I saw some of what he was doing on CNN Plus.
It's cool.
But I already know Rex.
And so that's the advantage.
And everything about it was approached in a way that didn't really make sense.
And it's over.
It's already being shut down
April 30th.
And think of the money that was spent.
And again, as I've said this before.
If we got a cash infusion that was just 5% of what was spent on CNN Plus,
we 10x what we're doing.
I mean, we take the content that we developed over time, which we know has led to a decade of growth.
Right? We've never had a year where we shrank.
Every year we grow.
More than a decade.
15 years.
And we just dump that content in front of tons of people by Google ads and YouTube ads.
And Twitter ads and all this different stuff.
We don't try to reinvent the wheel.
We just say, let's put what we're already doing that works in front of more people.
And it would have been much better giving us 5% of what it costs to launch CNN Plus, a much better investment.
Let me know your thoughts about the news and streaming wars.
At least temporary decline of Netflix.
The end of CNN Plus.
All of it.
Find me on Twitter.
@DPacman.
The David Pakman Show is, of course, a viewer and listener community-supported program.
We don't have a money tree.
We don't have a coin plant in the backyard or anything like it.
We depend on you.
And you can sign up at joinpakman.com.
You can also, if you have a membership, gift a membership
to somebody else.
There is a box that you will see that says, is this a gift?
And if the answer is yes, you just check the box.
If you don't know who to give a membership to.
Don't worry.
We have a list of nearly 700 people waiting for free memberships.
You can also request a free membership
at davidpakman.com/free membership.
Let's speak to some of these great members and non-members alike.
We take calls on Fridays at discord at davidpakman.com/discord.
Let's go next to Alex from Baltimore.
Alex, go ahead.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Cool. I got a question about publicly funded elections.
Sure.
So I know it's a long shot in the United States, but hypothetically, if one were to happen,
how does the money get doled out?
Because I know, you know, if there's an independent, a bunch of other independents, and a bunch of other party members, do they get a share of the money, or do they have to meet a certain qualification? This is a great question. So listen, there's no one way to set this up. So what do we mean by public funding?
The idea is the limit of the amount of money that can go into an election. And I have to say, it's so loud where you are, Alex, would it be okay if maybe I use you to answer because this is a very important issue.
Hang on, can you hear me better? Yeah, I can hear you fine. Just so much background noise.
So the way we would set it up would be, we might say, okay, once you meet a certain signature threshold, then you qualify. And it can't be like 300 signatures, right? It really has to be significant, so you don't have 100 people. Then you get X amount of money, you get X amount of local television time, and whatever. You could do it on a polling basis. You have to be polling at least X percent. Now, some people will say, well, the problem is you need money to get polling. Okay, but that's another way that it could be looked at. You also might have different thresholds depending on the population of the state or the race that you're running. So you wouldn't necessarily expect a Senate candidate, a congressional candidate to have the same thresholds in terms of signatures, at least, because one is drawing from a much larger population base. So there's not one answer to the question, but it's a really important question. That has to be crystal clear when you put these systems in place.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I figured that was the end. Is there any examples of other places that do it?
I don't have any offhand, to be perfectly frank.
Interesting. Let me research that. Let me do one more quick. I promise.
Sure.
What is your guilty pleasure food? The thing that's just greasy and nasty and no nutritional value, but it's delicious and you're tearing up every time.
Man, I don't know, greasy and nasty. I avoid foods I consider nasty.
Well, I mean, look, I don't know.
I mean, you know, I think the Argentinian slash Italian chicken milanesa, which is a fried chicken cut. I am a fan of, I guess that would be greasy, although I don't have it very often.
I guess I could also say, what about like a dessert, something overly ridiculously sweet? I'm a big tiramisu guy. That's not a bad choice.
Yeah. All right, that's all I had. Alex, quick question. Would you agree that the top desserts are tiramisu, flan, chocolate lava cake, and pistachio baklava? Do you agree with that take?
I'm kind of a good old American boy when it comes to desserts.
Oh, please don't bring up apple pie. If you bring up apple pie, we're going to have to cut it off.
Let me meet you in the middle and have a key lime pie.
That's less obviously overtly offensive.
I'm more of a tart, so things like apple pie, lemon meringue, that stuff.
All right, we'll agree to disagree, my friend. Thank you.
Yes, very respectably, of course.
People can have differences of opinion and still communicate in a respectful way. Let's go to Roiland from Grand Rapids. Roiland, you're on the air.
David, nice to hear from you, man. It's nice to hear from you.
Thank you.
So I have a question about modern monetary theory.
So, a little bit of the last year, John Yarmouth, the representative from Kentucky, was on C-SPAN, touting modern monetary theory and accepting it as a lens framework to view the government and how it spends. I was curious, do you think that MMT will become more prominent and more mainstream, obviously mainstream, but more prominent framework to view policy making?
Here's the thing about modern monetary theory. A lot of people think about it, like something that you enact. Like, okay, we now turned on modern monetary theory. Now there's modern money.
It's not really a perspective, right? The fundamental idea of modern monetary theory is that currency need not be restricted in order to prevent inflation in absolute terms.
And that the creation of new money by governments
has varied effect depending on what the money is spent on.
And if you spend the created money,
we're talking about ones and zeros at this point.
If you spend or allocate created money in certain ways, it can be economic stimulative.
Whereas allocating that money other ways might cause inflation.
So it's not something we're now doing modern monetary theory.
It's really just a framework we would think about government spending in a different way.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree. I think the issue right now is kind of because, like, in years where we were in, I think, a deficit of some kind, where there was less money in the economy. Trying to get away from that formula because obviously we love inflation years, but we shouldn't be really having our balance in that direction where there's less money in the actual economy. So I feel like the Democrats in particular would have to reframe their argument on modern monetary theory, but as Stephanie Kelman said in her recent interviews that I've seen, I'm not sure how they are, but she's actually talking to like Senate or budget committee members and everything, so they understand, but I almost feel like they're trying to figure out how to reveal it to the general public.
Yeah, I mean, the concept can be boiled down pretty simply, which is like government spending doesn't just diminish the value of the dollar and cause inflation.
We need to actually look at what the money is being spent on, and it can actually have economically stimulative effects.
I mean, it's sort of like taking elements on demand side economics and adding more of a fiscal policy currency aspect to it.
I don't know the best way to communicate it, but I do think that because elements of it are correct.
It will hopefully become more of a part of the discussion going forward, is my hope.
Yeah, my hope was that it worked too, because when you read articles about modern monetary on whatever websites, they're always saying, like, oh, this is what we tried to do, and look, it's not working. Well, the thing is, actually, do they discuss any of these policies with any modern monetary theorists about controlling inflation and unemployment? The answer is, yeah. So, very good point. I appreciate the call. Yeah, definitely. If you can just have some more NFT people interviewed, that'd be great for it to become more public.
Yeah, we've had Stephanie Kelton on twice. Am I right that Lena Chernyava also is an expert on MFT?
I'm trying to remember. I think she might
I'm unaware. My guys would be like Rohan Gray and Warren Osler, obviously, and Randall Gray. Those are the main three guys that I listen to.
All right. All right. We will look into it. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You have a great rest of your day.
You too. There's Loyland. What a beautiful phone call.
Let's go to Pablo from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I've never been to New Mexico, Pablo.
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, great. So I'm not sure I really have a question. It's more, a while back you had asked... Why should we keep on bringing up the debt, like right-wing conservatives, and it's sort of touching on that. Wait, hold on a second.
I asked why should we bring up the debt conservatives?
Sorry, yes, in regards to COVID debts. Pretty much like when all these, let me see if I can understand.
So you're saying sometimes an anti-vaccine right winger gets COVID and dies.
And I said part of the reason to bring it up is that it exposes the incredibly hypocrisy and also futility of their perspective when they confidently say no one needs to be vaccinated and then they die.
And hopefully it'll encourage other people to get themselves vaccinated. Is that more or less what you're talking about?
Yeah, more or less. And the reason why I think is, as you said, you have to
they're confronted with, everybody was saying, people on the right, conservatives were saying, you don't need a vaccine, look, you're fine, you don't have to wear a mask, especially a mask, being mandated, not being required on planes. It does confront them with their own sort of beliefs. Actually, there's somebody that Joe Rogan interviewed on his podcast, Megan Phelps Roper. I've interviewed her as well. Okay, I hadn't seen that one. I was actually curious about that. She mentioned how exactly being part of the Westboro Baptist Church. She had somebody confronting her about all these ideas. She had, and it was a lot harder for her to, once she was politely confronted with all these different ideas. She sort of had to come to grips with that a lot of it didn't make sense to herself.
Yes. Absolutely well said. Thank you, Pablo.
All right, thank you, David.
Yes, let's confront politely when they have incorrect ideas.
Let's take a very quick break.
This is Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. WDUD and WDUD HD1 Delaware, WTC, HD1 Tennessee, Mountain Strange Radio, KYWLP, West Virginia,
or
City Online Radio,
Keysport, Pennsylvania, WCK.FM.
I am Amanda Richard. I've got two hours worth of music that I think you will love. We're going to start off like we usually do on the side of the family.
Close down like we usually do.
Side of the family in between. Little sorts of wild things for you, including a set of dance music.
Let's get started with our liquor.
Start off with an old bluegrass single.
From H.C. Lansford. And Paul Bowman.
John,
I wouldn't get drunk.
Turn up the dreams and the bacon and the pan of fries. Just put the cows out, crush the cream and the